You're listening to WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
Check, check, one, two. Look like a little country. Some rock and roll and blues. Cause we sure love playing for good people like you. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.
Welcome to Music Local and Sustainable, the radio show that features discussions with and the music of local musicians. I am your host, Dave Lake. This recording was made prior to the onset of the novel coronavirus pandemic and the shelter-in-place orders, so any references to specific concerts may change. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, we are talking with trombonist and arts administrator Edward E.J. Latta. E.J. Latta is the director of artistic operations of the Savannah Philharmonic. So tonight, we're going to be talking about the trombone and about musical nonprofit administration. Welcome, E.J. Latta.
Hi, great to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about your development as a musician and as a arts administrator.
Sure. I've been a trombonist since I was in about the fifth grade. So kind of the basis of my identity is I'm a trombonist. You know, I've been doing that for probably close to 30 years at this point. All my degrees in college were trombone performance. Did the bachelor's, did the master's. Taking a lot of professional auditions, thought my path I was going to be a trombone player in an orchestra somewhere. Took a lot of auditions, was getting to the point where I was comfortable with my playing, doing pretty well. Like it came up, you know, runner up on a couple of auditions. But I needed something to do to keep myself busy while I'm taking those auditions. And I thought, well, you know, if I start another master's degree, they'll let me keep my graduate assistantship. That's how I started studying conducting. So I wound up actually finishing a master's in conducting. But toward the end of the master's there, I got a call from the Wichita Grand Opera, which I'm from Wichita, Kansas. They had called my professor, who was playing with the Oklahoma City Philharmonic. He is a professor down in the Oklahoma City area. They were short a trombone player in Wichita, and he was busy. But he said, well, I've got this graduate student from Wichita that would be great. So I said, sure. I took a week off classes, went up, visited my parents, and played for the opera company. And as I'm leaving, I say, thanks for calling me. Have me back anytime. If you ever need an assistant conductor or anything like that, you know, give me a call. And I get this email back from the head of the opera company saying, well, send me your resume. So I did. And then next thing I know, this was in April. By June, they've got me up there interviewing for a position on staff. And so by July, I've got a full-time job working for an opera company, sort of as a music administrator, which for those who don't know what that means, at least at that point, was I would sit there and, you know, when they contract the orchestra for the year, that means all 70 or 80 people in the orchestra have to get a contract. So I would take the template and modify it for each particular person to make sure that they're contracted for the performances they can do. And that's what I did. I handle the paperwork in the background. And so over the years, it's kind of grown through more responsibility. And now I'm here in Savannah doing much the same thing. And it's got a little bit more complex because now it's also looking at, okay, if we want to program this piece, we need how many people and we need what equipment. So how much is it going to cost us to produce it? What if we do three rehearsals instead of four? What if we do three, but one of them stretches to overtime for half an hour? It's all those kinds of budgeting numbers, and then also the logistics of if we need extra percussion instruments, we have to rent, we have to do that. When do we need the stage crew to load in and load out and move stuff around? It's all the little details. Or when do you need video screens and projectors loaded in, or any of that kind of stuff? So it's kind of constant puzzle pieces. So I do that, and at the same time, I do still try to keep myself up as a trombonist and conductor at the same time and keep those skills up because, again, kind of personal identity, I still consider myself a trombone player first and administrator second, really.
Let's go back to your life as an undergraduate and graduate student.
Sure.
Well, where did you go to school?
It was the University of Oklahoma. I went there being from Kansas, one, because they offered a little bit better scholarships than the nearby universities, but also the trombone professor in Oklahoma, Irvin Wagner, is former past president of the International Trombone Association, kind of knows everybody in the business, and he's really a master teacher. He's like the last still living student of Emory Remington, who was at the Eastman School, kind of legendary teacher of trombone. Irv is at this point in his late 80s, so I don't know how many other students of Emory Remington are still running around, but he's one of them. And so just the chance to learn from him was fantastic. He's the kind of guy that if you look at a Mahler symphony and you see a marking in there that you don't really know, it's like, that's not usually a trombone marking. What do they want me to do there? He says, well, I know a guy in Vienna. Let me call him up and see how they do it in Vienna, because that's where Mahler wrote it, so they would know. It's those kinds of things that kind of drew me to Oklahoma to study with Irv Wagner there.
And you did both your bachelor's degree and your first master's degree in trombone performance.
Yeah. I knew that I didn't really want to go down the education route. I don't have any problem with it. It's just that my personality is not particularly suited to that endeavor. So I chose not to go a music education route, to go more of a performance route.
And so how does undergraduate performance degree in trombone differ from a graduate degree in trombone?
It's really just the intensity of the focus, I think. By the end of a undergraduate performance degree, you've given probably a junior recital and a senior recital. Junior recital is maybe about half an hour of music that you learn and you have to put on it as a public performance. A senior recital is maybe a little bit more difficult music, but more like about 45 minutes worth. By the time you get to graduate studies, then it's a little bit more intense on the musicology, like the music history, the music theory foundations of things. But also, they just expect you to be able to play more difficult things, more like maybe an hour. You also kind of have to give not really a lecture to the audience, but you have to be able to go in front of a faculty panel and kind of talk about all the pieces on your recital and what's significant about them and how they relate to the trombone and its development. And then also, you have to write a graduate thesis and be able to go and defend that in front of your professors as well. Whereas an undergraduate is more kind of jump through these hoops for 4 years and you're pretty good. So
jump through these hoops and play your recital.
Yeah.
Period.
Pretty much. Yeah.
As a master's student, then you have to show a better understanding of the trombone literature, where what you're playing fits into the larger trombone literature, and then write a thesis as well.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned that you went on to your second master's degree in conducting primarily to keep your graduate assistantship.
That was the original motivation. And as I got more into it, there's a lot to learn here in conducting, and I seem to have a bit of a knack for it. I mean, maybe not to the level of going and putting myself in a Mahler conducting competition or a Bruno Walter conductor preview or anything like that. But it seemed to come somewhat naturally to me, and so I was just stuck with it.
As part of your assistantship, did you teach undergraduate classes?
I did. I moved around my assignments as a graduate assistant. At times, I taught kind of undergraduate trombone lessons if Irv was out of town or if he was on sabbatical. I did spend about a year as a music theory graduate assistant. So that means you get to teach counterpoint inventions to the freshmen and grade those sorts of things. Once I started conducting, I got moved over and was the default assistant conductor for the university orchestra and opera programs, which is kind of where I also fell into opera. I really love opera from a conducting standpoint because it's beyond just having this great music written. Then you've also got the staging and the acting and the costumes and the special effects and all this other stuff going on is really compelling when it all comes together as an art form. So that's kind of where I really sort of live as a conductor is over in that opera world.
What periods of music seem to be emphasized both in the opera program there at University of Oklahoma as well as, say, in the symphony orchestra?
I think one of the nice things about being in at least the university programs that I was in Oklahoma is that everyone involved actually had a nice balance of trying to both develop the standard repertoire that musicians should be familiar with when they get out into the world, playing your Beethovens and your Schuberts and your Mozarts. But they also were really strong advocates for new music. So I know in the university orchestra, we played Luigi Nono, we played George Crumb, things like that. I know the opera department, sure, we did like our Traviata and our Romeo and Juliet, but we also did Benjamin Britten's Turn of the Screw, which is a really creepy little piece if done well. The stage director was so good at that one. It was a nice mix. There was a group on campus called the New Century Ensemble that was all new works. So I wound up conducting a couple of things, like Luciano Berio has this wonderful piece called O King that's about Martin Luther King Jr. It's for soprano and I think five musicians, and it uses a lot of extended techniques, especially from the flute. The singer has to sing with a very straight tone, no vibrato, this very cold tone. They did a fabulous job, so there's a recording somewhere in their archives now of that performance. The soprano was Julie Davies. She's singing in a bunch of European opera houses now, but she did just a fabulous job on a really hard piece. It was nice being in an environment that really said, we don't have to worry about ticket sales so much, so we can really afford to explore some of these pieces that maybe don't get performed by professional groups as much.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, we are talking with trombonist and arts administrator Edward E.J. Lotta. And then you moved on to the Wichita Opera.
Right.
Which had to depend upon ticket sales.
Yeah. And so when you get into that kind of world, you do see that you kind of have to play the big hits. And if you're in a bigger, more established market, I know Keith Cerny, who used to run the Dallas Opera, would always say very clearly, you schedule a big something like a Carmen, and maybe you do 20 or 25 performances of Carmen, and you sell them out, and it's great. And maybe then you can pay to commission a new something that's more experimental, and maybe you only get to do three or four performances of the new piece, but there's a balance. Wichita was kind of a young company, though, so we really did kind of emphasize the ones that sold the best, that kind of kept the company afloat, were your Bohems, your Rigolettos, your Aidas, that kind of thing. So it was maybe not a place that was ready to try to, or didn't have the financial resources, really, to try and push the envelope with some of the newer repertoire.
Your education was really musical performance, as in performance as a trombonist and performance as a conductor.
Yeah, definitely.
How did you then move into more arts administration?
It was a combination of a couple of things, and one was a lot of on-the-job learning when I got to the opera company, just kind of seeing the things that need to be done and then going out and talking to other people in the industry and trying to kind of improve myself. And then I think part of it that I kind of skip over most of the time, when I started off as an undergraduate, I started off as a double major, and it was as music performance and chemical engineering. From that engineering side, I didn't stick with that very long, but there was a little bit of familiarity with spreadsheets and crunching numbers and setting up formulas to do things. From that kind of experience, so like say right now when we want to go out and do budgeting, I set up a gigantic Excel spreadsheet. It's all automated formulas. So if I change like number of musicians, number of services, how much overtime goes into it, all this kind of thing, and it just live recalculates the numbers. So if someone wants to know what's the difference between doing it this way and doing it that way, I just plug it all in and I can say, oh, well, if we add a rehearsal, then it's going to be another $12,000 probably, and get pretty close, you know, depending on a couple little things here and there. But so it's kind of like bringing that part of it into the arts world. And I would think probably most good arts administrators probably do the same thing. But it's just being able to set up those systems to be able to forecast and really know then when we can turn around and go to the department that raises the money and say, well, here's what we're going to need to make this happen.
It sounds like you're sort of the connection between the actual musical performance and the finance people.
Yeah, that's one of the functions, is to be able to really provide a picture of, if we want to go out and do some big piece and say, well, here's the resources that we're going to need to pull it off, both in terms of money, but also in terms of people and rehearsal space and all those other things. And so it's really kind of translating the artistic vision of the music director into the nuts and bolts of what do we really need to make it happen. And so that's kind of my function, is to just kind of provide that bridge there so that the rest of the administration can see what we need to make it happen. Where are the interesting things, like how do we market it? How do we sell it to people? How do we raise money to support it? All those other things can come together around that.
Is it you that then talks to these other departments in terms of, say, promoting a piece of work and talk to them about what the works are? Or is that the job of the musical director?
With our situation in Savannah, we just hired a new music director, and he's very busy as a guest conductor all over the world. So sometimes he may not be here, or he may be, as like right now, he's running on Tokyo time. So if we have a staff meeting, it's the middle of the night for him. It's great if we can get that directly from him to the marketing people, and we try to do that as much as possible. But then I'm also kind of a second resource that either maybe I see something interesting or a hook to draw people in that maybe he doesn't, or vice versa. So it's nice to have multiple eyes on those things, I think.
Are you in regular contact with Kay?
Absolutely. It's emails and text messages and phone calls, you know, if he's out of town. Sometimes I'll wake up and have 10 or 15 emails just on a variety of subjects that occurred to him, and it was the middle of the night here. So we try to stay in as close contact as we possibly can.
What sort of the things that he emails you about?
Oh, it'll be things like, hey, I talked to somebody and this is an interesting venue that maybe we could do some sort of project. Let's find a time and let's go visit this and see what we could do at this venue. Or it might be something where, hey, I had this idea. I'd like to work with this particular soloist for something in an upcoming season. Get a hold of their agent and find out, when are they available? Are they interested in this thing? It might be something like that. Or it could even be, hey, I wrote this to go out as email to some specific people. Could you proofread it? Make sure that I have all my details right. Or just anything like that.
And in sort of the reverse, if you're wanting to promote something, will you email him to say, what do you want to say?
Oh, absolutely. That's pretty regular when it's, hey, the marketing team wants a little quote from you, or can you do a 30-second video to go on social media? They need that from you, or any of those sorts of things. And sometimes I'll be the conduit for that. Sometimes they may just go directly to him if it's dealing with someone on the team that knows how to get a hold of him. Obviously, administratively, we try not to give out, you know, personal cell phone numbers and that kind of thing. So sometimes I am the go-between on a lot of that stuff.
And so when we look at the website, we see the description of that concert mm-hmm. coming up. Mm-hmm. How is that done?
Well, for a lot of those, and, you know, we just put our new season up on the website. And so a lot of that, they'll come to me and say, hey, we need a short paragraph talking about what is really interesting in this program. And so I'll write something, you know, and hand it to them and say, here you go. Is it too long? Is it too short? What do you like? And we just go from there. A lot of that does wind up coming out of my office then.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, we are talking with E.J. Lotta, the Director of Artistic Operations of the Savannah Philharmonic. Program booklet mm-hmm. that people get. In this case, you do two versions of it. You do one for the first half of the season, one for the second half of the season.
Yeah.
That's at least what you did this year.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be the policy going on as well?
It seems like that's going to be the model going forward. We've been trying to kind of cut down on waste a little bit, and so just doing one printing run that maybe works for multiple performances, we generate less overprint and waste that way. It also helps a little bit bring the costs down, but that's kind of a side effect of that. But so that's probably going to be the pattern going forward, unless just people have really strong opinions about it the other way.
in that program booklet, there are descriptions of the works.
Yeah.
And descriptions of the soloists. The soloists have their own press releases, and so they send you exactly what they want to have said. And it's sure. really interesting because when you see them, because I work on this side of the business too, when you see them, there's the short version, the medium version, and the long version, so you can pick and choose.
Right. And sometimes if they're a younger artist, they may only have the one version, and then that's part of my job is to go back to them and say, like, hey, we've only got room for 250 words. Can you cut it down? Would you like me to cut it down and send it to you for approval? How would you like to go about that? Just because I know I've edited a bunch of those at this point, so I'm happy to help them out with that. But sometimes they prefer to handle it themselves.
But the descriptions of the works.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Mostly that comes from me, and I'll sit down and spend, you know, to generate a program. It's maybe about a week, and I'll just really dig in and do some research and go and, like, just listen to everything to get it back into my head and really think about what's interesting in these pieces or the context around them. I try not to go too much into the deep musical analysis of the harmonic structure of the pieces because that's not going to be fascinating to most people reading it. You know, I mean, someone with a musical training and background might be super fascinated by that, but maybe to 90% of the audience, it's just going to be a lot of jargon thrown out there. So I try to find more of the interesting things to draw people in and give them a way to appreciate the music. If I were to talk about Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, which unfortunately is not on this season, hopefully someday soon, because I really love that piece. But so to talk about that, he wrote the whole symphony basically to impress an actress that he had a crush on. And so he kind of had this little musical idea representing her that keeps popping up through this whole thing. And by the middle of it, it turns into this really kind of crazy, like, opium hallucination dream that he dreams his own death. I mean, it's kind of a loony piece of music, but it gives you a way to dive into it beyond talking about the chord structure and the orchestrational techniques that he uses and those sorts of things. So I try to stay more on that side of the equation of just really kind of what's going to grab you by the guts and get you interested in a piece of music.
After your little introduction there, I figured by the time we got to the funeral march, it was things maybe weren't going good in the relationship. I don't know.
I'm trying to remember because I don't think he was particularly successful in wooing the actress in question, if I remember right. We got a great piece of music out of it. But
the other thing that's, I think, is of interest, certainly of interest to me, is the balance between the artistic and the commercial. The artistic, the desire to have this particular work, and the dollars and cents part of an operation of a arts nonprofit.
Yeah.
Which we are all hand-to-mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be hand-to-mouth in the tens of thousands, that's us, or it may be hand-to-mouth in the millions category,
yeah,
which may roughly, be some yeah. of the bigger arts organizations here in Savannah. Mm-hmm. But it's still hand-to-mouth.
Right. And it's a challenge. So I know, like looking at the upcoming season from Maestro Harada, he's very much trying to bring in living composers, works from living composers. And it's not everybody's cup of tea, but he tries to balance that it's not the entire program. So you'll see maybe a piece from Victoria Bond, but then you'll also see a Saint-Saëns piano concerto on that same program.
Two,
actually. That yeah, that's going to be an exciting one. But it's doing those sorts of things because I think we have to keep the viewpoint that music is a living art form. It's not a museum piece. And to think about, at some point, Mozart was a new composer. And how many other hundreds of composers were probably working at the same time? And so maybe Mozart is the only one whose music we still remember. But you don't get a Mozart without having all those other hundreds of composers working too. So at some point, we do need to provide a platform for these new voices to be heard. And not everything is going to be great. It won't all be just, you know, masterpiece. They'll be playing this in 100 years. Some of them might be duds. They might be flops. But you don't get a Citizen Kane without having an Ishtar or two in there. So to put it in cinema terms, I guess.
Well, and I just want to remind the audience that we're talking to E.J. Latta, and he was speaking spontaneously there. He wasn't reading script that I had provided him when he was saying exactly what I've been saying for many years here in Savannah. But now we have a director of artistic operations and a music director who are both sensitive to the need of contemporary music and living and breathing composers.
I kind of look at it, you always want to go and try a new dish from a chef, or you want to go and see a new movie from a director. Why not hear some new music from a composer? I mean, otherwise, where is the next John Williams or Hans Zimmer or James Horner going to come from if there's nowhere for them to learn how to create music? Yeah, we have to kind of open ourselves to trying new things.
What is the relationship of the board to the staff to the music director?
I'm going to see if I can boil this down here. Generally speaking, the board provides a couple of functions, and one is kind of oversight, that they set the really big picture, what kind of an organization do we want to be? What is our identity as the Savannah Philharmonic? So that kind of sets the criteria for who do we want to have as a music director. And so then we find Keitaro Harada, who is young, dynamic. He's on his way up. He's very talented, and he does have this very clear artistic vision that I think points us in that direction that the board thinks we should be going. The other big function of the board is kind of oversight, making sure we're not spending way too much money on stuff, that we're being fiscally responsible and doing things in a way that is sustainable so that the organization will continue to exist. So those are kind of the big key parts of the board. And then the other big part of a board of directors is to kind of be the people with the connections that kind of open doors in town. And whether that's having a connection to open a door to a partnership with another group like Savannah Music Festival, or whether it's opening the door to someone like a Gulfstream who can come in and sort of sponsor a project and put some kind of resources behind it. It's kind of those building the bridges then to turn it over to the staff. The staff's job, as far as the administration, is really to do our best to make sure that this orchestra functions well, so that the musicians, which is another part of the equation, so that they can go on stage and create these amazing performances. And that's really our job, whether it's raising the money to pay for musician salaries and equipment and everything else, or whether it's marketing and getting the information out to the public so that the public will buy tickets and come to see the performances, or whether it's like what I do, which is kind of the nuts and bolts logistics to just physically get the performances to happen. So that's really our job, is to take care of all that stuff behind the scenes so that the musicians can just go on stage and do what they do best, which is make phenomenal music. So I think that's kind of how we all interrelate. And then the music director, he's really the one that sits down and, you know, kind of listens to input from board and from audience members and from musicians about like what they feel is important artistically and all those sorts of things, and then comes to the table with, here's my idea for what we should perform. Here's what I think the programming should be. That we do have an artistic committee that kind of reviews stuff and says like, this is good, or maybe we don't need quite that many performances of this thing. Kind of little tweaks here and there, and then we arrive at, hey, here's our season, let's go do it.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul.
WRUU 107.5 FM is a new and different listener-supported and all-volunteer community radio station for Savannah. Our diverse broadcast and web programming is supported by generous listeners who value our passion and spunk. We are independent of other media and receive no government or large corporate support. People like you are the largest and most important source of our funding. Go to WRUU.org to find out how you can make a one-time or monthly contribution. Thank you.
This is a message from the Georgia State Department of Public Health. Social distancing means minimizing contact with people. It also means that if you are near someone in public, try to stay at least 6 feet away. The less contact people have with one another means the less opportunity for the virus to spread. Slowing the spread of the virus means that we can keep our healthcare system from becoming overwhelmed. More information can be found at dph.georgia.gov.
Now you have a chance to support both Savannah Independent Artists and WRUU during this shelter-in-place order to stop the spread of COVID-19. Creatives in Need is a group of independent artists hosted by the Roots Up Gallery, which is collaborating with WRUU during this shelter-in-place to offer an online art gallery at www.rootsupgallery.com. For every work of art sold at this online gallery, the artists receive 80% from the sales and 20% goes to WRUU and its programs like Art on the Air. Interested listeners can go to www.rootsupgallery.com to start shopping today.
Welcome back to Music Local and Sustainable, and I'm your host, Dave Lake. This recording was made prior to the onset of the novel coronavirus pandemic and the shelter-in-place orders, so any references to specific concerts may change. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, we are talking with trombonist and arts administrator Edward E.J. Latta. E.J. Latta is the director of artistic operations of the Savannah Philharmonic. So tonight, we're going to be talking about the trombone and about musical nonprofit administration. Well, let's change gears and let's talk about the trombone.
Oh, sure.
Now, in a symphony orchestra, everybody's sitting pretty much at the same level. Mm-hmm. Trombones are way in the back. Most cases tend to be toward the right.
Yeah.
So you don't see them much. They're not very visible. However, if you then go to like a jazz band,
yeah,
often they sit on risers.
Sure.
So the trombones are right out there front and center.
Yeah.
Classical trombonists, are you envious of the jazz trombonists, or is it more like, yeah, I'm fine where I am?
For me, I play both. I play a little of everything. But for the orchestra, it kind of does depend on the orchestra. Some music directors do like to have sort of the back of the winds up on risers. The difference is it lets the instruments project a little bit more without so many people and chairs and things in the way. It can also help just with visibility of just helping them see the conductor a little bit better by elevating them too. I think most trombone players that play in symphony orchestras would say, you know, either way, we can make plenty of noise. I've never had a problem getting my sound through an orchestra. I think one of the reasons is that trombones are very directional instruments. You have to be careful the way you sit. Your bell as a trombone player is, from your own perspective, a little bit to the left side. So you put your music stand to the right a little bit and kind of angle it so that stand is not blocking your bell and you kind of find yourself a clear lane to get your sound out, and then you don't have to work as hard.
And you don't want a poor viola player's head about 3 feet from your bell.
Right. That's an OSHA violation. We have sound shields to put behind musicians who are right in the blast zone, as I like to think of it. Some orchestras also do earplug fittings and do custom earplugs because I know hearing is a big concern, and it is a safety issue because we don't want to ruin anyone's hearing just from the act of being in the orchestras.
Well, showing my age, I don't remember seeing the blast shields before the 1980s.
I don't think they've been around that long, but I think orchestras are getting more aware of the hearing loss from the repeated exposure to loud sounds. especially as instruments are better made now. They're just louder than they used to be. With that, you have to be a little bit more careful with maintaining people's hearings. So it is more of a concern now than I think it used to be.
Let's talk a little bit about technique of the trombone. Many people are probably familiar with the trombone as a jazz instrument.
Oh, sure.
What is the major difference, the way you play the trombone, between playing it in a jazz combo and playing it in a symphony orchestra?
There's a little bit, depending on preference, there are some equipment differences just in how they're built. But the big part of it is it just comes down to how you play it. In an orchestral setting, there is an accepted ideal trombone sound that everyone really tries to emulate. It's this kind of big, open, unrestricted, very clear at the start of a note, and you want the end of a note to just stop really with no sort of articulation or anything. You just want it to just end and go away as cleanly as possible. The guys that really exemplify that would be Joe Alessi at the New York Phil, Jay Friedman at the Chicago Symphony. Those kind of guys are really your hallmarks in the United States for what an orchestra trombone should sound like. In the jazz world, it's much more a personal sound. Even though a trombonist like Slide Hampton might be playing on pretty much the same kind of trombone that Joe Alessi would be playing on. I mean, they both play the large bore trombones. You're not going to confuse Slide Hampton for Joe Alessi. It's more in the personality of how you bend the notes. Where do you use vibrato? Where do you not? The trend generally is not most of the time these days. How do you bend? Where do you put little ornaments on stuff to personalize it? Do you make your tone a little bit rough? That sort of thing. A lot of jazz players also typically, because they're playing longer sets, they're playing more, they play on a little bit lighter equipment. And this is getting like super nerdy here. So like an orchestra trombone is usually a quote-unquote large bore. So the inner diameter of most of your tubes is like 0.547 inches. A jazz guy might play on that size, but he also might play on a 5.25 size. The bell would maybe only be 7 inches around instead of 8.5 or 9 for an orchestral trombone. That smaller size, aside from that was just the size all the trombones were back in like the 20s, that smaller size, it's a little bit lighter. It's a little bit more agile when you play. The tone is a little bit brighter, so it punches through stuff a little bit easier. Whereas the orchestral trombones, they're bigger, they're darker, they try to blend in. But it also means it's a little bit more effort to play those. But it also means they can get louder than the little ones, too. So there's kind of these trade-offs that for a jazzer is very, very personal. Whereas for an orchestral trombone, you're trying to sort of fit yourself into that sound ideal to win an audition to get a job.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, we are talking with trombonist and arts administrator E.J. Lotta, the Director of Artistic Operations of the Savannah Philharmonic. Is that something that can be demonstrated here?
I could demonstrate some of it, I think. I only brought one horn with me, but I can probably show some of that difference. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay.
What would be an example of that standard sound that you have to have for your orchestral auditions on the trombone? And how does that compare to the more personalized sound?
I guess as an example, we'll just stick with the Mozart Requiem, because there's a really well-known trombone solo in the Mozart Requiem, in the tuba mirum movement. At the time, the first trombone player would have been playing on an alto trombone, which is like very small and pitched in E flat. So the solo was written in the second trombone part, who would be playing on the tenor trombone pitched in B flat, which is kind of what is the standard trombone now. When you audition for an orchestra, generally, you send in your resume and their personnel manager or whoever reviews all these resumes and their audition committee decides who they want to hear. And then you get invited and the invitations go out typically about a month in advance of the audition and they send you a list and say, this is what you will play. And there's usually not a lot of options to pick and choose. They just send you a list saying, be ready to play this list of music. The Mozart Requiem Tuba Mirum solo is on every professional trombone audition I have ever played. It's one of the first audition excerpts that you learn to play. And so it kind of exemplifies, I think, that sound that you try to get. So there are some others that come up a lot, like the Ride of the Valkyries comes up a lot. The trombone solo from Bolero comes up a lot, especially if it's an audition for a first or second trombone and not like a bass trombone. Schumann's Third Symphony has a really tricky solo at the start of the third movement that comes up a lot. Berlioz's Hungarian March comes up all the time. It's kind of, there's like this standard group of things that you can sort of expect to see. And then depending on the orchestra and what their sound is, there might be some curveballs thrown at you, like an unusual Strauss or a Bartok concerto for orchestra or something like that.
Okay, so what is the normal sound that they're looking for?
Okay, let's see if I can demonstrate this today.
So what are the characteristics of that, and why is that what they're looking for?
The articulations are kind of clean. It doesn't have like a lot of vibrato in it. Also, it's trying to be fairly strictly in tempo and not playing with it too much. There's a little bit of leeway because this is a solo excerpt and not a section kind of excerpt where you need to be really strictly metronome accurate. But it's that open sound. It's not overblown. It's not a rough sound. The ends of the notes aren't clipped or cut off or anything like that. Those sorts of things.
Can you give an example of what the more personalized playing
sure.
would be? Maybe if you could do that same thing, but a little bit more personalized?
We'll do a jazz interpretation of Mozart here a little bit. That was a little weird to combine those two like that, but that's kind of an idea where there's a little more you can ornament beyond what's on the page itself. I generally place the tone a little bit more forward, a little bit brighter, a little bit less concerned with the specific accuracy of things, but more with getting the feel and the idea of the music across. Or if I were to do something like Fly Me to the Moon. So there's a little bit more freedom to clip the ends of those notes to make them really pop and jump out of the texture, whereas the orchestral trombone is maybe a little bit more concerned with really trying to be very even and smooth. You know, things not one note just kind of randomly louder than the others around it, unless the composer tells you to do that. Those sorts of things.
And so it is that latter that you can do with in Picnic in the Park. And when you do the pops sort of things, because there's at least one concert that's sort of popish as well as then the Picnic in the Park concert.
Yeah, the musicians of the Savannah Phil are typically pretty good about being able to kind of cross over into that other territory to really give it a feel of pop/jazz kind of style. Our musicians do a good job of doing it authentically and not feeling like they're trying to do something that's really unnatural.
Are there other things that people should be listening for when they go to a symphony concert from the trombones?
It's interesting because when playing the trombone, I try a lot of the time to actually not be noticed. And I think it's because of where we are as far as the harmonic frequencies. The trombones really kind of help build the mid to low range of the orchestra. And so a lot of times it's not something that you're necessarily conscious of, but you'd notice it if it was bad. I've heard it summed up by someone saying that you can have fabulous trumpet players and they will still sound like garbage if you have bad trombone players underneath them. But if you have great trombone players underneath, they can make not so great trumpet players sound good. I'm certainly not saying that's the case in the Savannah Phil. Our trumpet players are wonderful. Trombones play a lot of support roles. So if those harmonies underneath are out of tune or if they're not on time, it can throw off the rest of the orchestra. So in a lot of cases, the best indication that you've got a great trombone section is that you don't really notice them very much. The difference is when you start doing things like Brahms' Second Symphony, where there are just huge trombone excerpts toward the end of that symphony, or like a Sibelius Second, or Mahler anything, or Wagner almost anything. There's kind of that other gear that you have to be able to shift to as a trombone player that really you punch through anything in front of you and really just kind of strip paint off walls if you want to. So it's that overdrive gear that's fun. At least for me, when I play, I try to pick your moments when you want to jump out and really take charge of things. And otherwise, you kind of sink into the texture and support. That's kind of what I listen for, but, you know, my ears are drawn to the trombone, so I'm, like, really paying attention to how they support underneath.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, we are talking with trombonist and arts administrator E.J. Lotta, the Director of Artistic Operations of the Savannah Philharmonic. Contemporary classical music composers are often looking for sounds that are not typical from the instrument. We tend to call those extended techniques.
Sure.
Where things are done with the instrument to produce a sound that one does not classically think of as the sound from that instrument. Are there extended techniques that contemporary classical music composers use on the trombone?
Oh, absolutely. The most common one is just the glissando, which is maybe not too unusual anymore, just because the trombone with the slide is one of the few instruments that can slide from one note to another without any break in the sound. String instruments can do it as well, but most of your other woodwinds and brasses, they have keys that get in the way. Good musicians can learn ways to mask that, like the opening clarinet glissando up on Rhapsody in Blue comes to mind. If someone's really good, they can make it sound really uninterrupted. But the trombone is one of the few that kind of natively can pull that off. That one's not maybe so spectacular to demonstrate. Other things that trombones can pull off would be the flutter tonguing, which is like in Spanish, if you have you roll your R's with that brrr kind of sound. If you do that while you're playing, then you get this kind of sound on a trombone, which you can make use of to pretty good effect, depending on where that comes in. The one that occasionally gets called for, I haven't seen it so much in orchestral music. I've seen it in solo literature pretty frequently, is multiphonics, which is where you play one note and sing another. And you can kind of exploit the harmonic overtones of the pipes, which kind of starts getting into the physics of the whole thing, to almost play entire chords, like almost if you wanted to play a cello double stop from one of the Bach cello suites. Like, I think there's one that opens with a G major sort of arpeggio from the cello. I think it's maybe the second suite opens with that. And you can sort of fake that if you play the G and then sing like the third of the chord. So you get and if you do it well and you're right on the money, you can get kind of all those overtones from the instrument to really pop out. And so it's a cool effect. There's a piece that uses a lot of that, actually. It's called Basta, and it's by Folk Rabe. He was part of a sort of a performance art group. So Basta in Italian or even Spanish really just kind of means enough. And so it's an interrupting piece where the rest of the group would be doing something else. And the instructions in this piece say you are supposed to barge onto the stage, interrupt whatever's going on, and it starts just abruptly. You don't wait for applause or anything, and it's very loud. Then by the time you get to the end of this piece, it again ends in dramatic fashion, and then you're supposed to just storm off the stage without waiting for any applause. And it's very theatrical. But he has a section where he has the trombonist play these multiphonics and actually glissando in opposite directions, which it's been years since I've done this one. I don't know if I can pull it off right now, but we'll give it a try. So it starts with this. And it's a really creepy effect in the middle of this tune. And he, it's kind of an extended section like that. So that's a lot of fun. As far as other extended techniques, a lot of what you'll see composers get into, especially with trombones, is the various mutes we can put in our bells to change the sound. And there's really kind of an endless variety of those. You see them a lot more actually in Broadway pits where you need specific sound effects to come out. There's mutes that can make you sound like Charlie Brown's teacher. There's mutes that can make you sound like an old Victrola. All kinds of things.
Yeah, that actually raises another question. Again, you see that a lot in jazz, but you don't that often see mutes in classical music.
The generic straight mute is pretty common in classical music. There's a little bit of a use for it in Mahler a couple of times. He will put a note in. The one in particular that we wound up calling a guy in Vienna to ask about is it said gestopft in the part, which is more of a French horn notation, meaning stopped horn, which is where you would put your hand all the way into the bell of the horn to stop it and get this really buzzy, brassy kind of sound. And it's not something you typically see on trombone, mainly because it's really hard to get your arm to bend that way with the trombone bell. And so that's why we called over there and they're like, oh, no, just put a straight mute in your horn. You know, that's all we do. So starting around that kind of like late Romantic era, you start to see the straight mute used. And it gets used pretty commonly in music from then up to now. The other mutes get more used either in the wind band world uses them pretty regularly or very modern compositions sometimes will make use of some of those mutes. But they're still kind of outside the norm for kind of your orchestral playing.
The other thing that if you're a jazz player and you're right up there front with your trombone, it's a little bit different than if you're an orchestral player back in the back again. And that is condensation that occurs inside the tubing and the releasing of that condensation.
Sure. Even your orchestral trombone players will have to do that too. I mean, the trombones, they come with a commonly called the spit valve. It's the water key at the end of the slide that a lot of people's reaction is, ew, gross. But it really is. I mean, it's just like a refrigerator or an air conditioner has a drip pan underneath. We're blowing warm, humid air into a gigantic metal tube. So it just condenses on the inside of the tubes and runs down there. And if you don't clear it out of the instrument, you start getting gurgling and bubbling and popping, and it doesn't sound good at all. If people are kind of up front, you're going to notice them doing that more. But even your players in the Savannah Phil are pretty regularly emptying out their water keys.
Yeah, if you don't empty it out, you suddenly have discovered a new extended technique.
Yes.
Is there anything else people should know about the trombone?
Oh, boy. I think it's a great instrument. It's a lot of fun. There's some really great music written for it that I kind of wish would get played a little bit more often.
Like what?
Oh, goodness. There's, even going back to, say, the 50s or 60s, I know the Paul Creston Fantasy for Trombone and Orchestra is a great piece. It's the one that kind of that does get played a fair amount. There are some other newer pieces. There's the Lonnie Grundahl Concerto is a fabulous piece of music. One that I would love to see someone come through and play is a sonata by Gunnar de Frumeri. I can spell all those names if you want them. But it is just a fabulous piece of music. And I think Christian Lindberg is really the only person I've ever heard perform it with an orchestra. But it's just not that common a solo instrument to see in front of an orchestra. I mean, you get lots of piano soloists, violin soloists, even cello soloists. Occasionally you'll get a flute soloist or a clarinet soloist, But not often do you see a trombone soloist get out in front. It's probably less common even than trumpet and French horn, and even percussionists, you know, come out and do the Jennifer Higdon concerto or something like that, or Evelyn Glennie comes into town and plays, but you don't see a lot of trombone soloists.
Because they don't exist?
I think there are plenty of trombonists who are certainly capable of playing and putting on a great performance. I think as far as people who really make a living doing it, the only one that's a full-time soloist is Christian Lindbergh. And he's been at it for decades at this point. There are others like Ian Boosfield, who used to play with London and Vienna Philharmonic, or Joe Alessi, of course, from New York, is a fabulous musician. But there are, I think, a lot of trombonists in the world active who are certainly capable of playing a lot of this repertoire. It doesn't get scheduled, I don't think.
So as you mentioned earlier, the trombone really became a consistent part of the orchestra around the time of Beethoven's Fifth.
Yeah.
Which is the end of the first decade of the 1800s.
Sure.
And although you did mention that indeed, and you demonstrated, and it is a required part of an trombone audition, that it's in the Mozart Requiem, which is about 20 years before Beethoven's Fifth.
Yeah, so it was right on the brink there. But I think even for Mozart, trombone still had this association. And I've heard it tied to Monteverdi, to the opera he did, the Orfeo. And so there's the scene where Orpheus is descending into hell to retrieve his beloved Eurydice, and he's accompanied by a quintet of trombones. And it's one of the earlier pieces of music that specifically says trombones play this, rather than just being music and you assign it to whatever instrument you have. And so from that, as I like to tell people, from that point on, whenever you hear trombones in music, up until Beethoven, if you hear trombones, someone's dying or going to hell. So it really did kind of grab that connotation. So even for Mozart, he only used trombones in those two scenes that are about, one is the supernatural with the statue coming to life and inviting himself to dinner to Don Giovanni, and then in Mozart's Requiem, which he was, you know, largely... Well, some people feel that he was writing for himself. I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I mean, it was a commissioned piece.
And it sounds like then the solo trombone as a featured artist in classical music really is the result of the middle of the 20th century.
Right. There are a couple of pieces older than that. The oldest one that's really a big standard is the Ferdinand David concertino. David was Mendelssohn's concertmaster, and so they had a very well-known trombonist in that Concertgebouw orchestra. And so they did write a piece for him, and that is actually in Europe extremely common as an audition test piece for European orchestras. And so that one is kind of the big standard from that sort of time period. And then there are some other pieces, but none of them have really caught on as far as really being a solo instrument that is regularly used. Yeah, not until probably mid-20th century, really.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, we've been talking with trombonist and arts administrator Edward E.J. Latta. E.J. is the Director of Artistic Operations of the Savannah Philharmonic, and we've been having a conversation about trombones and about musical nonprofit administration. I want to thank you so very much for coming in. This has been absolutely fabulous.
Well, it's been fun to be here. Thanks for having me.
And as the symphony season goes on, particularly next year, I think we'll probably try to get you in here to talk a little bit about each of the symphony concerts.
Oh, it'd be fun. I'd love to.
This has been another edition of Music Local and Sustainable, and I've been your host, Dave Lake. Save this time for another show next week.
Well, I know we ain't headed for the Hall of Fame. Gonna give it what we got, man, it ain't no shame. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two. Let me know if you can hear me. Check.
check 1, 2.